No, we talked about that. No,
I worked with him in the 90s.
But I told him my mom, some irrigation districts out there, you call the culture.
That'd be good.
All right, good morning, everybody, and apologies for being a little bit late. It was horrible weather up in Portland. Incredibly rainy and slow driving, but Chris was awesome.
You got it down. See, I almost got ahead of it because I was great water.
But we just kept going. Does everybody happen to have a copy of the agenda? I'm booting up as we speak, and I'm not going to connect up to the InFocus machine at this point because we're going to move into a presentation by Jerry and her team. Do you guys need that thing to do?
Which thing?
The InFocus machine?
Yes.
You do need
it? Yes.
Yes, that's what I thought. Maybe I didn't say that correctly. We're getting a lot of copies. I'm going to go through briefly the agenda and just see if this looks good to folks. And my personal goal is to get the heck out of here fairly early this morning. This was always an ugly drive back into Portland. I'm going to do our introductions and go through the meeting notes, some updates to go over. And again, all of that shouldn't take more than 30 minutes or so. And then we're going to move into Jerry's presentation. And after that, Tony has kindly offered to talk us through a fish pathogen database.
Stephen will do that.
You'll do that.
Well, yes.
Tony suggested that somebody do that.
Yes, anyway, Stephen will do it on Tony's behalf.
Okay, yes. This is why we call this a draft. But there is a presentation, though, right?
Correct. Okay. Yes, it's a 15-minute presentation, 15 PowerPoint. Minutes.
All right, good, that's what I've got. Yeah. Following that, we're going to have a tour of this facility, right?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. And I've never seen it, and I don't know if all you guys are familiar with it, but it should be good. We're going to have lunch, and I know, Jerry, you had sent me a link to, like, a restaurant or something.
Well, there is options for lunch are either people separate and go in town. I guess we could order pizza, and somebody would have to go in and get it, but Ruth offered to do that. There's also a meat market out here that makes great sandwiches, and if we think about it early enough, we'll get it.
Hold on. Number one in the valley for sandwiches. Just got ranked number one. Okay. Emmons Meats, which are
the one we just passed.
Yeah.
So we should do some sandwiches there. And can we put in an order?
It is meat only, I think.
Who does not? Yes. Who does not eat meat here? Raise your hand.
Okay.
Yeah. There you go.
I will.
Vegetarians are terrified.
I'll go down and print out what they have, and we can make that decision.
Because I think it would be best if we did have some sandwiches brought back, because after that, Dr. Schreck has offered kindly to give us a tour of his facility.
About 12:30 is when he...
About 12:30-ish, so we can eat lunch and take a little break and then wander over there and see that facility as well. So that would be awesome.
Just walking distance.
It's right there.
That's what I mean. It's you know, Cameron, you gotta get up and walk.
At least just
we'll provide you some
stretch our legs. And what do you think? About a half an hour to see that facility?
Michelle, talk to him.
Less than that, 15 minutes probably.
Okay.
Three sandwich options. So we can...
I didn't realize you...
I'll just write it out.
You should have known your computer was right on the line.
And then there's an additional agenda item that Cameron and I talked about a little bit. You're going to present some...
I'm going to give an update on the spawning survey, pre-spawn mortality, PEOS estimates for 2012 surveys. I've got the data and some analysis done.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I had emailed him last week, and I asked him if there's something you can present to the group, knowing that he's at the tail end of doing lots and lots of field work, and generally... We don't have the data to analyze at this point. And so basically my thoughts were we can just walk through your program, tell people what you're doing, and what you did and didn't do, successes and failures, whatever, for 2012. And obviously knowing the full report is months and months and months away. So that'll be awesome. And then the other thing I want to put on that I do have on the agenda, and I have an hour for the discussion, but we don't necessarily need to commit an hour. We've had multiple discussions over the course of time here with this group and other groups as well about fish handling protocols, outplanting, and I thought we'd have a sort of a roundtable discussion just to get this thing back on the table. I think, as many of you know, we tried to work with U of I last year and get Chris Caudill to put together a proposal to specifically look at outplanting at Dexter, looking at different methodologies for outplanting and then analyzing the results of that. The biggest issues are focusing on some of the density issues that we see down in the tail race. Well, we didn't quite get our act together last spring and have that prepared, but we are working right now to have that same proposal work through and hopefully have something completed so that when spring does come and our first fish start showing up, we can have a sort of a new program or a different type of program. Anyways, that's what I wanted to talk about that with this item. And again, it's just sort of a round table, get people's thoughts on where we're at. And if that sounds like a reasonable agenda, I think I'd like to try to get at it between 1:30 and 2 if that's possible. So we'll see how that goes. A little ambitious. But let's go down. Let's go around the room real quickly, starting in the corner there with Mr. Kane.
Jane Army Corps.
Bernadette
Graham
Hudson, ODFW.
Jerry Bartholomew,
OSU.
Go ahead.
Michelle Jacaitis, OSU.
Tony Mandy, ODFW Fish Health.
And I'll just start. Chris Walker, Army Corps.
Lance Kruzik, National Marine Fisheries Service.
Cam Sharp, OEFW.
Lawrence Schwabe, Grand Ronde Tribe.
Brett Boyd, OEFW, South San Diego Country.
Sasha Hallett, OSU.
Manny Ferreyras, OEFW.
Kirk Kramer, McKenzie Fish Hatchery, OEFW.
Rocco Salabongo, Power.
Karen Mackey, Corps.
And who's on the phone?
John Thorpe, ODFW.
Dan Peck, Willamette Hatchery.
All right, thank you. And this is Dave Lundhart. All right. Have folks had an opportunity to look at the meeting minutes that I sent out a while back?
Great minutes, Tammy.
And do we? Yeah, isn't that nice to have somebody officially write stuff down now? So we've got to be careful what we say. Don't, you're not recording all right.
I am recording.
Dave needs to give you a pay increase. You recorded that, right?
We don't want to talk. About that. Yeah. You guys cruise them for a moment. I'm still working on firing this thing up. How about action items in there, Tammy? Anything jumps out at you?
Action items. Anna, did you do any? Cameron was supposed to create a GIS map. Figured he'd be able to before this meeting.
Done that at the end of my discussion.
Okay.
Not done in the sense that it's done with the progress, but I've got a good start. Got a map.
Written comments were due on the PNNL Hatchery Wild Interaction Study.
Right, we have comments from ODFW. I submitted those to Jeff McMichaels basically right when I got them, and he is working to make those changes, but I have not had a chance to actually talk with him. He's called me, left me a message. I was out of town all last week and about half of the week before, so I've been a little bit out of touch. But those were the only comments we received, as I understand it, and so we do expect the draft to turn around fairly quickly, but I'm not going to give you a date right now because I just don't know when that'll be.
So he's revising the proposal via from the comments, and we'll submit that back for review.
Yes.
And then a decision will follow after that.
Yeah, and then we'll take a look and determine whether it appears to be a reasonable study to carry forward. And again, it's also based on funding. Funding is another bit of an issue again this year, and will continue to be with O&M. And as I understand it right now, the program that I'm running has roughly the same amount of money in it as it had the year before. So I'm kind of roughly estimating costs for Vern Klatt, who's the Fish and Wildlife Project Manager, Program Manager. But yeah, so if there's extra, I'm actually anticipating setting aside a little bit of money for this study, unless we absolutely determine it's just not worth moving forward with at this point, but that's included in my rough budget that I put together. Anything else on these meeting minutes that we, the folks, have anybody, have people looked through them? Have any thoughts?
I welcome, you know, any suggestions you have for improving them, because they're there for you guys, so just let me know what you want to see in them.
You got you hatchery managers, y'all had an opportunity to look through these, make sure Tammy captured your data correctly.
Yes. Somebody
else. That was unanimous? Yes. Okay.
All quiet there.
All right. Well, then, that's awesome. So we'll just assume these are approved. So let's move into the next agenda item, which are our roundtable discussion with the fish hatchery program managers and getting updates as well as from Tony. So who can we, let's start with Kurt. Can we start with there on my left?
Yes. Okay, well, the run is wrapped up. We finished up, we closed the trap on the 2nd of October. So we ended up collecting 3,873 fish, which was below average for us. We averaged around 4,400 for the last 10 years anyway. So that was something that kind of surprised me because we had 5,900 last year and 6,800 the year before, so it just trended down a little bit. We outplanted a total of 924 fish this year, and that was spread amongst three systems, the South Fork, the Mohawk, and the Smith River area of Mackenzie. Probably one of the people really interested is we put 429 fish into the South Fork above Coop. And our fish came in at 94.6% were marked. Out of the ones that were unmarked, we had 115 of those double index, which I'm starting to question how many are true on double index now, because we're starting to move away from our last releases of those fish, which are double index as a tagged fish with no adipose clip. But we had 115 of those fish. Next year, the ones from our last release of those will be around 6-7 years old. So I think we're getting away from them now. We had over 280 last year, so I think we're starting to trend that down.
Now, the double index are coated wire tags, though. So
right, so we can find out, yeah. What
after the snubs are red.
Right.
Whether they're just mislips.
Yeah, and within all those 1,400 we have, there are some of those fish in there, so we can pull
double index are not clipped at all.
Correct. Fish are not clipped, but you see coated wire tags to indicate that they are, in fact, double index fish, not a mislipped blank wire tag.
For other reasons. And I expect this to go down even farther next year, and then we'll be able to see, you know, we'll just have some misclipped, you know, that open the tag. So anyway, if we didn't include those fish, we were 97.5%. Marked fish coming into the hatchery. We had 93 wild fish coming into the hatchery, potentially wild fish. We spawned all those fish. We had a couple of mortality in there, but we spawned all those fish, and all of those were taken from, I believe, all those fish also. So we'll see how many were actually wild or not. Let's see here. Our egg take, we took 3.3 million eggs. We've already shipped 1 million eggs, eyed eggs, Snap Creek. I brought 27,000 over here for the fish performance lab. The fish are pretty healthy for the most part. Over the last 2 years, we broke with cold water disease in two ponds. We are in the process of getting medicated feed, which should come in on Thursday. So that was kind of a surprise because they've been very healthy all year. And I guess that's all I really have. Someone has some questions.
Where are the late spawned Marion Forks fish?
They were in Marion Forks. They just picked them up yesterday.
Hey, Kurt, any idea what the Lieber count of wilds was this year?
Yes.
You going to get to that?
Yes.
Okay. What was it?
15 to 16, something like 15 that. 15 to 16. Yeah. I think I might
be able to. So, could you speak to the SAFE program for just a minute? You said you took a total of 3.3 million eggs?
Yes.
What portion of that goes towards the SAFE program? Do you have any idea?
Well, we put 250,000 smolts towards SAFE. So
whatever percentage survival from eggs.
260,000 get ponded probably for that program.
Yeah.
But how many eggs?
How many eggs?
Do you or Willamette provide the eggs?
No, we provide the eggs for that.
To Nat Creek.
Oh, for Nat Creek? Yeah, they get a million eggs. So you're looking at, for the whole program, then, for us, probably about 1.5 million would be, you know, pretty close with mortality, you know, 8K mortality. It could be less one, you know, some years and more other years, depending on our, we have a little spike in shot losses this year, but still it was in that neighborhood.
So those all go to SAFE programs?
Yeah, the million that go to Nat Creek are for the SAFE program.
And that stock has gone back and forth between Mackenzie and Willamette over the years, and the last several years has been Mackenzie's.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Kurt. Any questions, Kurt? All right, Brett?
Things at South Centium are going well. Chinook eggs were done there. We had three eggs this year, low loss. We transferred about 1.3 million to Willamette. And then we had some excess, about 72,000 to finish off the SAFE program for Nat Creek. And the juvenile fish were doing well. The steelhead juveniles were great. The fall release spring Chinook, they're going to go out this week. And they're at size, and got some nice increased flows to release those fish in, so that should be well. We just pulled all the outplant pipes at the release sites, so they don't get washed away, because they almost did, but anyway. And we're going to close the trap this week as well. There's a few more just steelhead in it, basically, now, and a few sockeye by the looks of things, but we're going to... collect some more steelhead brood. Our steelhead adults this year have a new clade, IHN, which I'm sure Tony will talk to a little bit, but we've had some increased loss here lately, and we're expecting to have to cull some IHN eggs this year, which we have been IHN free for the last 3 years, so kind of a drag, but we'll see how things turn out. And then they also have little sea shats. Sea Shasta, so we're losing right now about an average of 15 adults a week, and which is I think is going to go down here real soon. But anyway, we'll get a few more brood here once we close the trap. We're starting to see some equipment. The contractors are bringing some equipment out to foster, so it looks like that's going to start going, the new adult rebuild. And as far as adult dispositions, I kind of closed out our numbers, and I don't know if you wanted me to go through everything. I have a few extra copies if some people, so you wouldn't have to write it all down.
Well, that'd be great. Thanks. If you could pass them around, whatever you've got.
I only got like 4 or 5, I think. I wrecked all my numbers yesterday. Destroyed all my hard work. But the outplant numbers are the numbers are good, but we're right now off one as far as a male and a female, but the numbers are right. So anyway, I did go back through and change everything in Hemis, but anyway, we had a total of when you include jacks, 8,229 fish returned, a little over 70,172. Add clip fish, 1,057 no marks. All the no marks went upstream, and they were distributed between three sites, Riverbend, Falcon, Ford Road. And those distributions are down below there at the bottom of the sheet. About 13% of the returning adults this year were unmarked. We, as far as just disposition of the ad clip fish, we recycled 1,262, we spawned 684, 35 died, adult holding pond mortality. No, it was reruns collected, I'm sorry. We collected 1,262 reruns. We recycled 2,161. A little over 2,641 went to food bank. 943 fish were stream enrichment, and of those 943, that includes the 684 that we spawned. We sold 2,029 to a fish buyer. 561 went to tribal obligations, and 64 went to landfill. So, and then, also on the adults there, it would be interesting to see, but they all the outplants were tagged with number tags and outplanted to different sites. And then the U of I also did some radio tagging and pit tagging of some of the adults that went upstream. And the steelhead, we trapped 6,572 new fish. And we kept 1,136 for brood. To date, like I said, there's probably another 100, 150 in there that we'll process tomorrow. We recycled 8,423 this year, so we recycled a bunch. And we'll give a few. These numbers aren't quite final because we'll give a few more to food bank. But we sent 143 to landfill so far. We gave away 1,210 to food banks. And we'll probably start spawning those fish late December.
So, Brett, your Chinook return above or below average?
Well above, yeah. Average is about 4,700, I think.
Kurt's below, you're way above.
We're way above, yes.
That's strange. I don't do steelhead, though. You asked steelhead, right?
No,
oh, Chinook. Oh, okay.
What's the best estimate on the marked fish? How many of those are hatchery fish?
What do we figure?
Last year's about 17%.
17%.
Yeah.
What does recycling mean?
So we take fish that excess fish that we don't need for brood stock, we put a buoy tag in and recycle it back downstream for the anglers.
Okay.
So
we go back into
the fishery.
Okay. Wasn't sure.
Yeah.
My fish reality.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm recycling this. Recycling this. Back into the
fish. Yeah. Right. Thank you. Does ODF&W use the marking trailer for every one of their facilities? Or are some of these hand clipped?
Ours, the fall release at our facility are hand clipped.
All of ours are automatic.
Yours are automatic. Because 17% mismark seems like a high number, doesn't it? If you're
no, it's not 17% mismark. It's a relative abundance of the hatchery return versus the wild return. If you have a low number of wild fish return and a very large number of hatchery fish return, then a small mismark rate translates into a larger proportion of fish that appear to be wild. It's just a numbers game. The hatcheries, the marking traders are operating at very high rate of efficiency.
That's why I
don't see any way to easily increase the efficiency and accuracy of the marking.
Yeah, very good. You figure 2 or 3% of a million and a half fish, that's a lot of fish.
Right. Yeah. You
know, it's a lot better than it has been in the past with hand clipping, where it was very routine for unclipped hatchery fish to grossly exceed the number of genuine many of the systems
that I was watching a special on OPB the other night, and somewhere down in Coos Bay, some hatchery facility, and they had virtually some school children out there all just clipping away like mad. Oh boy, I hope you don't use this for management purposes.
That's abandoned.
I mean, that was a great idea.
Yeah. I think size, that's the size that you mark them out, really makes a difference too, because when they're small, you know, your error rate's higher, and then you also have a higher probability of regeneration on bad clips. And whereas, like, I know our fall release, they're marked at 25 pounds, so they're quite large, and we have a really good success rate on the marking, but that's not always possible because there's only so many trailers and stuff.
Right. And starting next year, those numbers are bumped up to the average fish per pound, especially on Chinook and the Valley, so that we don't miss that low end of the bell curve. we have shifted everything to the right, so larger average to start marking. So that
to start marking?
To start marking, yes.
So the release size will be the same?
No, everything is the same, but the marking dates have been pushed back in order to not miss those little guys on the low end of the boat there.
So when will the marking, is it a month different or weeks?
No, it's, what was it, a week, 2 weeks?
I think that's all it was, yeah.
Just a, less than 2 weeks.
Pretty dramatically. Could you repeat the total number of summer steelhead you said?
So summer steelhead total number was 6,572 big fish. We average about, about 4,700.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So it was above average return, but we also, this was the first year that we released those additional 40,000 that normally would have gone to the North Sandy Ham, to the Minto.
Right.
Those over there for a while.
Okay, any questions for Brett and the program? Manny, are you going to speak for Greg's?
Yeah. Altogether, there were 843 adults captured at the Apple Bennett, of which 321 males were marked, 436 were female marked also, 5 jacks for a grand total of 762. We had 37 males non marked, 40 females, and 4 jacks for a grand total of 81. They spawned 268 pairs. The spawning occurred at the McKenzie facility, and they had an overall egg loss of about 4.4%, which is pretty good. Also, the BKD positive on ELISA test, it was pretty low also, about 1.8%. And they didn't have no visual BKD positive as they were checking the adults, they were spawning them. One thing is that for Greg, he's going to be in Portland for the next month. He's going to be doing a shadowing. He's on a shadowing assignment at the core office in Portland, so you might be seeing him attending different meetings. Aside from production component is last week we had our first quarterly meeting with core officials. This was kind of a follow-up from the cooperative agreement. I think and I hope everyone that is in here, and it was a pretty productive meeting, short and sweet. Basically, the scope of the meeting was to discuss among the group the ongoing productions at the facility and also changes in program. Again, when I say changes in program, it's perhaps moving a production from one facility to the other within the Willamette Valley. As we presented in that meeting, we have about 3 months ago, we made some changes. We moved the production, the Clackamas production that we had at Marion Forks. So that production got moved to Bonneville. We still have some of the production at Leeburg. Basically, 300,000 fish that will go later on to Sandy. And another component of about 300,000 that will go to Clackamas. Again, as you could have heard from other meetings, also we are in the process of making some changes, probably within two years, moving some production from Willamette, that's the Molalla component, to Marion Forks. By doing that, that will provide us give us the flexibility to move the ongoing, the 267,000 spring chinook that we are releasing from McKenzie into the Coast Fork, they will be moved and produce being raised at Willamette with a Willamette stock. Also in the near future, and by the way, this production is part of the state component. We're also going to be moving, in the future, we're going to be moving 100,000 from Mackenzie to the Young's Bay. This is in the works right now. So when all of this gets completed, we'll pretty much what we're going to have on Mackenzie will be almost 100% mitigation production. There is a small component in there of about 40,000 that most likely we'll find a home later on.
What was the number that you used for Coast Fork? I couldn't hear you.
267,000. Okay. That's what we have been putting in there. Yeah.
So, Manny, all these changes were to accomplish what? What was the backdrop on that?
Well, two components. The first one is to, you know, with the cooperative agreement, to bring a higher degree of transparency, you know, where some of that production is. I think, you know, for quite some time we have been trying to move the production at Marion Forks, and I think after looking at all the components throughout the whole area, you know, in my area, we were able to move those fish to Bonneville. The other one is as looking at is again, this is kind of it's an exercise in production. It's trying to come up with some space availability to accommodate, you know, the production that we had at Mackenzie. The other one is that in the long run also we are looking at alternatives and how to, there is something there that is kind of, I see that as a dark cloud, you know, it's every single day, and that is to provide the core with some flexibility when it comes to move some of the production from Dexter. Yeah, so again, Dexter, that's a big, that's a major issue in there because we are talking about a lot of pounds, roughly about 180,000 pounds, which we do not have the space. However, I think as things kind of settle, we'll be able to accommodate and be able to move some of that production someplace within the Willamette Valley, so that we don't violate some of our hatchery policies within the state.
So can you speak to the Bonneville piece again? Mm-hmm. It's hard to follow this, but what are you doing over at Bonneville? You're rearing.
So what we're doing, you know, we are taking a component of the spring chinook is being reared at Bonneville. And then from Bonneville, they would be moved them. It is being done between Bonneville and Osborne. And then that production would be released, moved later on back to Clackamas.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's the Clackamas component that we're rearing temporarily at Willamette,
right,
and then at Marion Forks.
Yeah.
Now it's going to Bonneville.
These are Clackamas.
Yes. It's just a space issue. There's space at Bonneville for a certain amount of rearing time, and then you're going to move them back?
Well, as a matter of fact, it's more than that, David. This is pretty much what we did. We moved some fish from Bonneville to other facilities to accommodate that transfer of Clackamas to Bonneville. So this is very complicated. But
it is.
Sandy's back.
You should get a Vizio's, you know, thing out here and just diagram all this stuff. You probably actually have it.
Sandy, I cannot do the math in my head. I'm sorry. It's too much moving around. But is there a chance that the decreased rearing at Mackenzie would accommodate my
density
experiment?
Yes.
We discussed
that's
that.
Part
yes.
of the reason we're removing some of those fishes to allow that to happen.
Yeah.
And it can happen effective 2015 brood, 2015 rearing, or 2014 brood, or 2015 brood?
14
brood. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. 2014 brood. That's, okay, I'm going to have to worry about that. That's
That's forever down there.
Yeah, you couldn't accelerate it any faster than that. Sorry.
No, that's right. I'm here for the duration. I think it's a great idea.
So is that definitely going to go through the SAFE program? Programming?
You mean the 100,000?
Is that a guarantee now?
Again, I would say it is almost there, okay? But like Scott mentioned, it's I mean, you know, the legislation kind of come up at the last minute and said, sorry,
right?
It's not going to happen. But pretty much what they asked us to come up with a plan, and the plan was presented to them. So it's up to them now.
I suppose some of that will also depend on how the ballot goes, which I assume is going to lose, but if for some miracle it passes, then that throws everything out the window.
Yeah. Right. Questions?
One more thing that Manny didn't mention is that we discussed was the revamping of the adult pond at South Sandingham for either fall or spring releases of his stock that are currently being reared at Willamette, therefore taking even more pressure off of Willamette for the SAFE program or for other programs, state programs. So that's something that the Corps will need to get involved as we rebuild, foster, perhaps. Brett knows more about this.
I got to make sure on this one is that, you know, that discussion has been on the table for quite some time. Basically, you know, the intent is eventually is for us to have moved the whole spring chinook production to South Sandingham. Many times we have been looking at, for some of you that have been at the facility, toward the east side of the brood pond, there is some space in there that we have been asking the Corps for quite some time for some capital improvement, and that is to put in there some of those portable raceways in there, and so we can rear those fish in there. By moving now the adults, you know, to the new to the new foster facility, that it provides some opportunities for us to use that as extra rearing. One of the things is that right now it looks as a potential, okay, that we can use that to rear some of the fish that are going to Dexter. However, there is a glitch in there, and that is, I believe, the construction of Dexter is going to start in 2015. Meaning that we are not going to be able to use that that adult pond for Willamette production unless the construction of Dexter get delayed a little bit more. So, but again, these are some changes in programmatic. You know that we are always working, trying to come out with some becoming more efficient. You know, and not only that, but also giving the facility the full grow out spectrum so that they have a better control. You know, we reduce transfer of fish, name it, which is better for the fish as we raise them.
Right. Are these changes just in the conceptual talking phase, or are these things going to happen? And if they are, is this being documented somewhere? So that will the Corps get a record of this?
Okay. Again, there are some of the changes that we talked about, Willamette. Yes, they will occur. Again, everything has to go through our annual production meeting, which normally happens between the end of July to August. That's when we put those numbers in there and they become official. When it comes to South Sandingham, and again, everything is pending on foster. You know what I mean? If once we move those adults to foster, then that brood pond is going to be empty. So basically, we can use it, you know, for rearing fish in there, which is really, we don't have to make a change because it is part of the facility. So
some of this, I think, is documented. Chris, did you get a letter from Scott?
No.
Not yet. Okay, no. So it's going to be documented in a letter that Chris asked for last week at the meeting.
Yeah.
And some of those numbers should be in that letter. So our documentation is going
to be. We're supposed to get some of the information mid-November. Some of the stuff that Manny's referring to, I'm not sure where that's going to be documented at, but I think it's similar.
Okay. Again, whatever is official would be on that document. And I believe Scott is supposed to be sending to you sometime in next month, which is 3 days from now, or 2 days from now. That would be the AOP, you know, some of the definite changes in production. So you will be getting those shortly. Not only that, with that, there will be a diagram similar to the one that you get on the annual report that basically will pinpoint where the releases are happening, you know, and where they're coming from which facility. So it's, again, the intent is to be very transparent of this whole process. So.
That's great. And then you update those, your hatchery operations plans yearly, those documents that you put out?
Yes, yeah.
Great.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I believe by now you should have that report, the last draft.
Yep.
Yeah.
You have, all the Willamette hatcheries and more. So.
Okay. Hey, all right, thanks, Manny.
Before we move on, can I just collect the sandwich list?
Yes,
and
please.
Does
everybody who wants a sandwich has
got to call that order in?
Yeah, please. So remember how much we're going to collect money for these before we go collect them.
Oh, I
agree. Or Ruth's not going to like this job very much.
Buffalo,
Yep.
They did their own pulled pork on site.
So what I'll do is Emmons meat worker.
Rock my lunch today.
Well, I'll get Emmons to have this ready for 12 o'clock pickup. Sure. If that sounds good.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thanks.
Dave,
so we need money right now is what I'm hearing.
No, we don't need it right now.
No, I brought my own. I didn't know they were going to do this. Otherwise, I'd love
it. Okay, everybody has what they want.
One more.
That's a different meeting.
Dave, I don't want to get lost in the conversation about the Dexter or the South San Yamato Old Pond. It's nice if we can use it for rearing fish from Dexter during the construction, but long term, I feel it's a critical component of rebuilding the hatchery part of the facility, not the foster part, but the hatchery part for him to be able to rear all his fish in basin.
Have those discussions taken place at the Dexter? At the Foster PDT?
I don't know.
Does anybody know who?
Yeah, they did early, and then the decision was made that the
they're separate.
Chris that I think that it was to be strictly adult.
Chris Bedai?
Yes.
Yeah, that's kind of the messaging I've been hearing about all the facilities. Is they're it's separate than the hatchery.
Yeah.
It's different funding.
They're
focused strictly on the actual adult trapping facility itself.
That's too bad.
Yeah, it is too bad.
Frustration with that.
We've run into that on several of these pieces.
We were actually trying to, why they were built, because many of those, like the Chinook rig ponds, will be empty for 8 months a year. We were trying to, just to get a few minor tweaks to those vessels to where we could rear juveniles in them part time, and it was, just because they wanted that separation, they want to draw a line.
Well, and I think to the defense of these program managers, project managers, it's this color of money issue that
we deal with
constantly.
No, it's a nightmare. It's just unfortunate,
So, my strong suggestion is work through this man right here.
Chris Walker, the director.
Yeah. All right, hey, thanks. Do you want to add anything to, you were at that meeting,
I think they pretty much covered it. We basically discussed where we think the program's headed in the near future, meaning in the next couple of years. A lot of it just had to do with mitigation production and what we fund and where those fish go versus what the state funds and where their fish go. And the result was basically we'll be providing them kind of what we thought we agreed to, and then Scott's going to be providing us a production and release schedule in mid-November that lays out kind of where we're going to be going in the near future.
Yeah, I think this is wonderful because we're really striving, both agencies are striving to show greater transparency, and I think we're getting there. And we have to move on because we're really behind time, but Manny, let's say one more
thing. One thing that I forgot is that's in reference to the Minto facility. I would say it's about 70% completed. The project is on track now. It's they were behind a few days, and the Corp went and made a deal, gave more money to the contractor. So the facility is planned to be completed by the end of March. And I have had the opportunity, just went there about 2 weeks ago, and telling you the workmanship, it just looked nice, very nice. The pipes, excellent work so far. So.
It looks like it could withstand a superstorm. Sandy wouldn't touch that thing. It's quite a remarkable structure. So we still have Dan on the line. So Dan Peck, if you'd please give us an update, and then we'll move on. Because I'd like to have Tony speak briefly to some of the disease issues that are going on, and then we'll wrap this up. Go ahead, Dan.
Hey, like everybody else, we finished with our adult collection. We ended up with just over 8,400 adults returning. Brood went okay. We had about a 50% loss in our brood overall. We ended up spawning 621 pairs, which is a little less than I wanted. I wanted 750. But with real low BKD levels this year, I think we'll just squeak through with production. U of I did their studies again, and we helped them out with everything that they needed. We held 100 fish up here and treated them like our brood, and then outplanted them right at the very end. The last week of August, we outplanted them. I haven't seen any results yet of you know, the survival rate of those fish or anything. Out of that 84, 33 adults that we collected, we had 136 that were unmarked. 23 of those U of I outplanted, and the rest of them came up into our brood stock. We went through our first two egg takes, and we're right on schedule with normal loss, about 7% egg loss, which is pretty much the norm for us. And we're gonna shock the third group tomorrow and start picking on them. We received eggs from South Santa Am, look good, and so we're going there. The smolts are all doing well, Rainbow are doing well. We had a shot of cold water a month or so back, and we treated for it. We are still seeing signs of cold water. I think Tony will talk about that, but our loss is normal. It's not killing anything. We're just seeing it here and there, and even in some of the Chinook. So other than that, everything's moving along.
Hey, Dan, this is Ian. What did you say the loss was on your adults this year? Was it pretty high?
No, it's roughly average. It was 30% overall. We had like a 25% on the females and 37% on the males, which is normally the opposite way. We usually have higher on the females, but 30% is pretty close to normal.
Okay. I was wondering, since we tried to do temperature control this year, if it had any influence on it.
No, not really, not on the adults. It did help with some of the smolts at Dexter, but it just pretty much delayed the inevitable.
Okay.
We ended up with Colin Nurse and Frank at Dexter. It was just about a month or 6 weeks later than we normally get it.
Okay. And your trap is closed right now, correct?
Yeah, the trap's closed.
When did it close?
I think we ended up closing it right at the end of September. I don't know the exact date.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious because I heard yesterday from Greg Taylor at Fall Creek, they don't usually operate the trap this late in the year, but they're operating it now, and they had 50 summer steelhead pour into that thing yesterday. So I'm just wondering, how late in the year do you see summer steelhead coming into the trap? But I guess that would be dependent on the trap closure date.
Well, I know that Greg Taylor fishes summer steelhead in the Middle Fork through November into December, so they stay in the river for quite a while.
Okay. Are those direct release, or are those acclimated at Dexter?
Those are acclimated at Dexter.
Is there any direct release at all in the Middle Fork system? Is there scatter planting?
Nope, they're just all flushed right out of Dexter. I mean, we do a scatter plant down lower in the lower river around Valley River Center, but those are reared at Roaring River Hatchery.
Okay. Just kind of curious where the summers are coming from. All right, thank you, Dan.
Yep.
Great, thanks, Dan. Any questions for Dan?
So your 8,400, is that average, above, or below?
That's about, I would say, 1,000 fish above average, but not that much above. We've had as low as, 3,000 on bad years and as high as 12,000 on really good years.
All right. Any other questions? Tony?
Okay. We're going to start with Middle Fork. I remember last meeting, Lance asked if the water control, the temperature control was helping, and it did help quite a bit. Unfortunately, like Dan mentioned, it just delayed the inevitable. Things were doing extremely well until probably the first week in October, and then we started seeing problems at Dexter in one of the ponds, the one most heavily loaded. We got furunculosis on that, and shortly after that, they got, the other way around. They got Columnaris, and then they got furunculosis afterwards. And then Pond 4, which had been suffering a low-level loss compared to last year's, which was, again, an unknown loss. We have no idea what was causing it. And we were riding along with a steady chronic loss, and then all of a sudden it spiked very, very rapidly. And it was furunculosis. And then shortly after that, they also got Columnaris. And I just found out today from Dan that Ponds 1 and 2, which are fall release groups, are starting to die of probably both Frunk and Columnaris. But we're dealing with these things 6 weeks after the normal outbreaks. We're usually treating in July. We didn't treat until October this year. which is pretty amazing. So temperature control is critical, and the continuation of that is really helpful. So we need to do that. By the way, we're going to release ponds 1 and 2 before the loss gets to a point where it's problematic, rather than wait to treat and then release 2 weeks late, which probably is not good for the fish anyway. So those will be gone this week.
But at some point, you get that warm water that has to go, right?
Well, it's like Detroit.
Yes,
it's
and,
like Detroit.
And that's exactly what's happening.
So we've gone below the spillway. We've lost control of it. Yep. So what's going on now is that warm water is falling, and sitting in the RO, and boom, it's coming out. Right. So you're
it prolongs the inevitable.
And that's what it. But in the interim, you're having good rearing conditions for the fish, and they're in much better shape for when that does hit. And Dan mentioned this morning to me that actually. He's seen his temperature about 5 degrees above normal for this time of year as well. So you got even warmer water than normal going into the reservoirs, which is going straight into Dexter right now. So on a normal year, maybe this would have been low-level loss that we wouldn't have to treat it. So I urge you to continue doing that. So that's the middle for it. Like Dan mentioned, we had cold water disease that will have it on the rainbow. We treat it, and it went away. We are again seeing the... which to me is very bothersome. We saw cold water disease on both Chinook stocks, both the South Sandingham and the Willamette stock. The loss was very low, but we're starting to pick it up on a fairly regular basis. I think the future is that cold water disease and Chinook are going to become real close buddies, and we're going to have problems with those issues. And we're seeing it at McKenzie, like Kurt mentioned. It's interesting because I showed up at McKenzie, I did my exam, ponds were doing great. 2 days later, while I was at a meeting on the South Coast, these guys sent some fish over to the lab. Craig looked at them and said, 100% cold water disease. I went from nothing to an outbreak immediately. So my guess is that they probably had the EIBS virus, the erythrocytic inclusion body syndrome virus, which is what we had last year on two ponds. Same thing, two ponds. And so they're going to start being treated this week, and that normally take care of it. EIBS goes away as temperatures go up, which we're going in the reverse, but we'll see how we deal with that. I'm going to McKenzie on Friday, so I'll have a closer look at what's going on. Marion Forks is doing great, no problems there. South Sandingham, the juveniles, the smolts are doing super. We picked up virus on both the Chinook and the steelhead this year. The steelhead, unfortunately, is on green females, which is not typical, but it has happened in the past. The interesting part is that the Chinook and the steelhead are carrying two different viruses, and they seem to be sharing very well, passing the two strains back and forth. The steelhead virus is the first time we've ever picked it up in Oregon, and it's from the Skamania hatchery, Skamania steelhead stock. So leave that up to your minds as to how that can happen. You know, they're all the same strain. Do they go out to the same spot in the ocean and talk to each other out there and pass viruses around? Or do they come back and stray? Some go from South Sandingham to Skamania, some from Skamania to South Sandingham. We have no idea what happens to them. But the loss was unusual for us this year in that we lost no fish through the middle of September, right, Brett? Not one steelhead died. From collection in mid-May through the middle of September. That's extremely unusual. And then all of a sudden, a few in late September, and then in October, like Brett mentions, we're getting anywhere from 5 to 7, 8 a week, or a few more now.
Yeah.
We've sampled them 3 times. I will sample them again when I go there next week. And the virus pretty much in the steelhead is this Skamania strain of virus, which is an M-plate virus, which loves steelhead rainbow.
Its common name is called Skamania strain?
No.
What is it called?
You don't want to know. Right. It has like three letters and 7 numbers.
Got it. Skamania works.
Yeah. It's the one that they've been finding in Skamania with losses in juveniles and smolts. They haven't lost adults, but they have lost juveniles and smolts from that strain of virus. So
has this been seen in other Skamania stocks that are elsewhere outside of Skamania?
You don't know. I need to have John go search through the database. There's a database that USGS maintains where they have all those, where the stocks are. Unfortunately, we do our own work. Everything else is done through the USGS for Washington, Idaho, California. They send their samples to them, and when they're backlogged, it's hard to try.
Tony, the rainbow trout are susceptible to the summer steelhead virus
yes,
as well. So
very.
The winter steelhead would be as well? Or
very.
That's besides me.
Yeah. So, and that brought up part of my concern when we were talking about moving the winter steelhead adults from the Middle Fork to Detroit, even though, you know, the Saniams are positive for the virus. We've never seen this strain in Oregon, let alone in the Saniams. So Cameron and I have been talking about this, and one of the possibilities is to use eggplants. Essentially, take adult sample and then use negatives to plant eggs in the system. But that's discussions that are ongoing. But that's pretty much it. So we've had a great ride through the summer into the fall, and all of a sudden, everything fell apart all at once.
I mean, is there anything very alarming out there, or is it all very alarming?
No, really, nothing is alarming. It's all treatable, except for the IHED issue. We have had losses of steelhead, much lower levels, with the virus. Brett mentioned Ceratomyxa shasta early on. About 60% of the fish had Ceratomyxa shasta and IHN. The last two samples has been zero visual Ceratomyxa shasta spores. Doesn't mean that they don't have it and they're not dying of it, but the likelihood is that it's strictly IHN killing the adults at this stage. They're showing all the signs, the hemorrhaging, everything. It's definitely IHN killing the adults. But in the past, we have picked up virus starting as early as June. And then spawning time, it's either very low or non-existent. So we don't know. Or we could get some really high levels of virus, which means that Bonneville is going to receive a lot of eggs from positive parents. We sample 100% of the fish, both males and females, and we try and send 100% negatives to Oak Springs. And then anything else that's part of required for production goes to Bonneville. So.
Tony, do you think we should be concerned about North and South Saniam at this point? I mean, do we have enough data to say that those summer steelhead would not be infected and there wouldn't be any influence on the winters, or do you think that's a concern right now?
You know, we try and sample as many winters as possible at both Foster and Minto. That's not going to happen this year, of course. And we try and get as many of those samples from ripe females and males and sample them, but like Brett mentioned, we haven't seen virus in the south for over 3 years now, in either the winters or the summers. And every year the winters were positive, well, 90% of the time. We've never seen problems with them. But we'll see. Well, we're going to stay on top of it. We're going to do a lot more sampling than we normally do.
All right, great, thanks. Any questions for Tony? We've got to move on quickly. We're about a half an hour behind schedule right now, but Chris, do you have any quick updates on operational?
Sure. I can be brief. Besides the obvious increasing flows due to the rain, we have a few special operations going on. One at Cougar, which is starting up in November, which is a day-night operation, which entails generating during the day and then attempting to pass fish to the RO at night. And that's for the Harmony efforts that are going on. We also have a Detroit Harmony project going on, same sort of deal, where we're operating the RO along with the turbines, being on and off, and trying to pass fish, and we're monitoring that with the 203 study done by USGS. And then last, which is further on down the road, in December we'll be drawing down Fall Creek and Cougar. Most of you are probably aware of kind of what's going on with that.
Does that day-night operation at either of those facilities affect water temperature dramatically downstream? Are they so close together?
It probably depends.
We maintain temp control at full 1571 feet at Cougar.
So you can do that while you're doing that.
The concern with the day-night operations has been the increased risk of violating ramp rights that are listed in the biop, just because you're doing it on a daily basis, therefore you have higher risk. You
might try to balance and juggle.
Gas cap.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's
great,
it.
Thanks, Chris. Any questions for Chris? All right, let's move quickly on to our next agenda item, which is Jerry Bartholomew and her team have requested. Can you give us an update on some of their findings? And I'll let you just go ahead.
Okay. Well, my AV person is getting things set up here. This is going to be mostly a presentation by my team because they do most of the work. But I think you're all familiar with what our project is. This is a project that was put forward by ODFW to look at some of the disease risks associated with hatcheries in the Willamette Basin.
Is that too dark?
No. Shoot the laptop.
Oh. Okay, so the people that you're going to hear from this morning are briefly myself. Sasha Hallett, who is a senior research associate in the lab, is going to be talking last about some of the assay development. Rich Holt, who I think a lot of you know, has been instrumental with helping out technically on the project, and there are two graduate students who are working with on this. Michelle, who is funded through a fellowship with ODFW, and Sean, who is just starting as a graduate student this term, but who did a lot of field work this summer that he's going to talk about, is funded on this project. We've had a lot of help, both with ODFW pathology, fish collection. Sean's been working really closely with Kirk Schroeder's group, and of course, all the hatcheries. And we've been spending a bit of time with Carl Schreck and Mike Kent and talking about how we can interface with their group. Yesterday we had a meeting with Jim Peterson, kind of sharing some of our Willamette River ceramics and data, talking about how to model some of that data so it could fit into some of their predictions or answer some of their questions about causes of adult mortality and where fish are getting infected with pathogens in the main stem Willamette. So I'm not going to talk about that at all today, but that is something that we're also doing. So what are some of the risks between pathogens and hatcheries? I think you all know these. One of them is introduction of pathogens into the hatchery. We know that most of the hatchery water supplies are unprotected, and they contain fish, as well as another risk is transfer of pathogens via fish being transported into the hatchery from other locations. So those are two of the risks in hatcheries that we're looking at. Amplification of these pathogens certainly occurs within the hatchery, and I think you've just heard a couple instances where that's happening right now. We're also looking at release of pathogens from the hatcheries, and Michelle and Sasha will talk a bit about more of those. We're not looking at as much at pathogen dissemination between watersheds, but that eventually may be some of this research will be informative for some of those risk assessments. Amplification of pathogens outside of the hatchery is being addressed a little bit in Sean's examination of wild fish, and he'll talk about some of his findings in just a little bit. But I want to keep things moving along here. So we have a number of pathogens that are associated with disease outbreaks in hatcheries at the Willamette system. We have a long database. ODFW has years and years of data, so we know what we're looking for. And I think Michelle's going to go briefly over what those pathogens are, but I think Tony basically just gave that list. Pneumonas, the flavobacterium, IHN, and renibacterium. And the pathogens that we see in the adult salmon that are returning to the hatcheries are pretty well documented. All of the hatcheries in the Willamette system are using surface water that adult salmon are migrating through, and water treatments within any of these hatcheries is pretty limited. The options, treating that large amount of water, there aren't very many hatcheries that do that. There's Cowlitz Hatchery on the Cowlitz system, the salmon, the trout hatchery has a large ozone treatment plant that they use, but really there aren't very many other hatcheries that have implemented large water treatment on that scale. I think there have been some test facilities in Colorado that have used combinations of filtration and UV, but the scale of these hatcheries makes some of these options difficult. So what we are hoping to do with this project is examine some of the risks, look at ways at really what the true risks are. We hear a lot about release of pathogens to hatcheries. Is that really occurring on a scale that is jeopardizing wild fish populations? So those are some of the questions that we're trying to address. So the overall aim of the project is to evaluate risks of pathogen transmission between naturally and hatchery reared populations, so going in both directions to and from the hatchery. And the order of presentations is as follows. Michelle's going to talk first about looking at pathogen transmission to and from hatchery populations.
Thank you, Jerry. So, again, the aim for this testing, my project involves testing for pathogens above and below the hatcheries, figuring out spatial distribution, and just generally what's in the water and at what amounts. So to give you a quick overview and refresh your minds on the project and the pathogens, we have four bacterial pathogens, one virus, and these have caused problems in the past and also currently, and are still projected to be a problem in the future. So cold water, frunk, Colnaris BKD, and IHNV, which we've been seeing recently. For our methods, we have a couple different ways that we try to detect these pathogens. We use sentinel fish exposures, so placing groups of juvenile salmonids, Chinook and Rainbow, both in the hatchery influent and in the hatchery effluent, as a way, sort of as a canary in the coal mine, seeing what's coming into the hatcheries and also what's coming out. We also have the wild fish survey, which Sean is going to talk about in more detail. And then also the water sampling. I conduct these at the same time we do our sentinel fish exposures. So we take samples, water samples, both at the start and the end of our exposures. Usually these are 1 week exposures. And so we have a variety of methods trying to wrap up this idea of what are the pathogens and can we quantify these levels and see what the risks are for transmission. So in terms of where we're working, Willamette River Basin. Last year we were working only with McKenzie, Leeburg, and Dexter. This year we've expanded that to South Santiam, Marion Forks, and Willamette. And we have continued baseline monitoring at McKenzie, Leeburg, and Dexter, but we wanted to have these additional three in case we were to see disease outbreaks and we could take advantage of those and place sentinel fish during those. So I'm going to give you an overview of just of what happened this past summer. We had quite a few modifications for our methods in terms of trying to use what we learned from last year to try to improve what we did. So we had some changes in our sentinel fish, also looking at the disease outbreaks at the hatcheries and then also their water sampling. So to start it off, the hatchery baseline monitoring. So last year what we did is we checked, we exposed sentinel fish for seasonal monitoring. So spring, summer, late summer, and then fall, also in the winter, to see if when you have a hatchery that is not undergoing any disease outbreak, do we see any differences in pathogens, in sentinel fish survival, and we did not see a seasonal effect. And so the question was, well, when are we going to see, in terms of the outbreaks, we did see a difference, like at Dexter, in terms of sentinel fish survival and also pathogen detection last year. And so for this year, we wanted to optimize our chances. So we really focused on the summer, and we wanted to have a 2-month continuous sampling period over the time when we thought we had the best chance of seeing a disease outbreak. So from the beginning of August until the first week in October, we placed groups of sentinel fish at all three hatcheries, McKenzie, Leeburg, and Dexter, and we hold them there for 2 weeks. And then at the end of those 2 weeks, the same day we pull fish, we replace them with a fresh set of fish. So in that way, we covered the entire, I guess, water flow for those entire 2 months. And then at this point, after the 2 weeks, we bring the fish back here to the SDL and then monitor them for any any signs of disease development. And hold them for 30 days and then terminate them so about every other week. It's been 800 fish, which takes a full week, and then a crew of about 5 people doing a full necropsy, so going ahead and doing bacteriology on 2 different types of media. For the hatchery outbreaks, we just had a couple that happened right near the end of summer and in the fall. IHNV was not technically an outbreak since it was in the adults at South Santiam, but again, we had Colmenaris and Frunculosis over at Dexter, and then cold water at McKenzie, and possibly EIBS at McKenzie as well. for this case, we had a couple of modifications. We used, like last year, we used the most susceptible fish species or the most relevant species depending on which hatchery we were working with. So placing spring chinook at Dexter, rainbows on South Santia, and a combination of rainbows and chinook at McKenzie. Going into a little more detail, at Dexter, placing fish, here are a couple examples of mortalities we saw. This guy was actually still alive when we caught him.
Oh, wow.
Felt pretty badly for him. But for this, we extended our downstream sites. This is one of the things we did. We still had our groups of fish that were held both above, so we had fish above, directly below in the effluent. And then our question was from last year was, could we see a difference in terms of pathogen detection or sentinel fish coming down with disease farther downstream? And so we chose two different sites, about 200 and 400 feet downstream. This depended on, first of all, just watching the river and looking at trying to get a good balance of mixing between the hatchery effluent and also the rest of the river. And also we were just limited by physically where could we put fish in the river where they wouldn't get bashed around by the current, where could we attach them. And so we went ahead, held them there for week-long exposure, and then pulled them, brought them back to the SDL, and are still monitoring them. For McKenzie, same general concept. We had rainbow and chinook we exposed. Here, it has two intakes, so our above sites, Cogswell Creek, and then also the canal. And then here's the effluent fish ladder right by it. And so for this, again, we also had two downstream sites at about 200, 400 feet below the effluent, again, taking care to watch to see what the water was doing and trying to get the best mixing. And then here we also went ahead and took some additional water sample to look for EIBS, but I'll cover that in a little more detail later. So something else we were interested in was for water sample bacterial plating, which was just by taking water from the river, could we see the pathogen? So what we did is at the same time, we'd go and we'd place these sentinel fish during these outbreaks. We would take water samples, and we'd take aliquots of those water samples and then streak them on bacterial media just to see if we could detect pathogens that way. Those are still growing up, so we're still waiting to see on them. Another thing we were working on was water sampling for viral pathogens. This past winter in January, we did some water filtration over at Lieber to see if we can detect IHMV there. We did not, and then we had this opportunity to try and see if we could repeat this again at South Santiam and McKenzie. So what we do is we use tangential flow filtration, which is basically a way to take a large volume of water and then concentrate it down. So we went from 10 liters to about 100 mils in a long process that takes about 10 to 16 hours to filter that down. We keep the samples on ice the whole time, and as a way of checking, we do visualization with the stain that stains DNA. And so here's an example of pre-filtration, post-filtration, to actually visualize and make sure that the filter did in fact work. And so after we go ahead and we do this, we filter it down again, so we only have the viral fraction, and then that we take inoculate on two different cell lines, and then monitor that for CPE. So we're still waiting on that too. The BSV is not culturable, so we have saved samples for qPCR and PCR. So that's sort of wrapping up where we are in terms of this summer. Our baseline monitoring, we're still working through those samples. We're still waiting, keeping an eye on those fish, waiting for the 30-day mark to be terminated. And the same is true with the disease outbreak. So just trying to keep on top of all the fish, keeping an eye on their health, and working up any more abundant fish. In terms of where my project is going, this is one part of this huge project that's becoming my thesis. So I'm combining sentinel fish exposures, looking at the historical analyses, what has happened at these hatcheries in the past, molecular detection in terms of what Sasha is doing, and then also conducting different lab-based experiments, all to wrap this up into hatchery risk assessment. And so that's the end of my section. I can take a couple questions now before leading into Sean's, if anyone has anything.
When am I going to see the results?
What's that?
When are the results going to be available?
So we're going to finish terminations probably December and January, and so that's when we'll have a full set of, you know, what was the health of these fish. It takes about a week for the bacterial plates to grow up, and then I record those, and then it takes a couple of weeks for the virus. But just in terms of completion, we'll have that at the end of all of those fish terminations.
Do you have any sense of what happened with the monitoring fish?
So the monitoring so far has been very, very clean, very few colonies, if any at all. We do see some environmental colonies, but those have been very clean. And so I project that that's going to be the same for the baseline, and then for the hatchery outbreaks, I think it's too early to tell. So we'll see what happens with those.
Michelle provides me with semi-annual reports. Would anybody be interested in seeing those?
Okay.
Send them to you. You can pass them on.
Yep.
Okay.
That'd be great.
I have the first one, and the second one is on the way. So they're very short summaries. They're not data laden, and that's not the intent of it. So, but at least it gives you an idea of what's been going on.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, and as I said, this is Sean's first summer with us, and he took over the wild fish sampling portion of the project.
So I'm just going to give you guys an update of what I did this summer. I got here just in June. And so just, again, a little quick overview. As Michelle and Jerry said, the natural pathogen flow comes from the wild water, so that goes into the hatcheries and then out. So the survey was just kind of looking at a baseline health status of what was out there in the natural reared populations close to the hatcheries. And then again, hoping to compare those, any pathogens or parasites we found, to anything else we found in other aspects of the project. So the surveys went on four different sites along the Willamette, starting up on just all four different tributaries, main tributaries to the Willamette River. So we got Marion Forks, South Saint Anne, Leeburg, McKenzie, just kind of treated as one area because they were so close in proximity to each other, and then finally Dexter. Again, reiterating the specific pathogens we were looking for, the four main bacteria is a concern, and then IHN. Just as a note that we would see, this is a case of just some environmental non-pathogenic bacteria that would pop up in some of the surveys that we did, but as I later, when I mentioned bacteria, I'm more concerned, or more referring to if there's presence of any of those specifically. So overview of how just went about sampling, made two efforts at each site, targeting juvenile salmonids, so about 3 to 4 inches around the hatcheries. We went from July and August, so we went one effort at each site in July and then again in August, with the exception of Marion Forks, because of time and scheduling, we only got one effort in July. This was just kind of based on ODFW, who we were going out with, if they had any availability with their crew and equipment. And then I got some additional specimens from other ODFW projects, some gillnet projects and lookout, and then screw traps to get some samples above the dams. After we captured them, they were just the fish were euthanized in the field and then transported back on ice to OSU for diagnostics. So these are the primary methods we used. Our main craft was the e-fishing raft, so we had a 3-man crew, including myself, manning, and we would go down and just sample different areas with the electroshock boat. And then we also supplemented that with different historical sandings. So if we found areas, if they had kind of slower water, we would try getting different schools of fish. And then we also had a backpack shocker for at Marion Forest because we couldn't get a boat, obviously, into the creek area. So this is just an overview of one of the sites at Sassanium. I'll explain how a typical day would go out. Obviously, because of the physical limitations of the dam, we couldn't start above and just go float down. So based on the timing, we just started right below by the effluent, so we put in as close as we could to the effluent, and then from there, go downstream with the shock boat and also the sanding, looking for different areas where we thought we'd find juvenile somatics, so woody debris, logs, and any side channels, then we'd get out the equipment to sane for schools of fish. Then we just label them up, mark them where we found caught the fish, and then throw them on ice and take them back to the lab for full necropsy. So that included looking at external signs, any lesions or hemorrhaging, then doing bacterial samples, so just scraping the kidney with a metal loop and then putting it on auger to see if any cultures grew up. Also took a small piece for defat slides to look for BKD presence. And if we did catch a fish that was large enough, we would also do an ELISA to see any BKD presence. Also take viral samples and then would grow those up on cell lines to see if we had any virus present. And then finally, we'd look at most of the tissues for any presence of specific or any parasites.
So how long does an individual fish work out?
Takes about an hour. So it is kind of a lengthy process. So that is one of the things also kind of limited our takes when we went out. We had to kind of take a notion that if we got 60 fish, that would be about 60 hours of work. And it would have to be pretty soon after, otherwise they would be going. So we were under a NOAA permit for takes, so we had a certain limit of what we could take. And so we split that up based on the two efforts that we would. So we had an idea of at least what our max take would be that day, and then also taking into account the time limits of actually working those fish up. You see those are the total numbers, just shy of 300. Out of that 300, 242 were salmonids, and then that's just kind of breakdown above and below overall.
Above meaning above the hatchery?
Yes,
intake.
Above hatcheries, yeah. The above does include, as you see, split up above Mackenzie, but that's technically below Lever, but so that's why the number is a little higher. But here, just starting off at Marion Forks, is pretty early on in the data analysis section, but it just kind of took a quick relative frequency of what we saw in bacteria and virus, and then some main parasites that did show up in overall in the survey. As you can see on this, Marion Forks is pretty clean. Below, just found one instance of a tapeworm or a cestode, and then above, found trematode, Apophallus, and then some other trematodes, and then nematode or roundworm. And here is just some pictures giving examples of what those were. So the cestode, tapeworm, you can see the head, scolex, and then reglottids. Rhabdocona is a roundworm that you find in the intestine, and then also a trematode or a fluke that was also found in the intestine. Here is what we got from Sassanium. As you see, unfortunately, didn't get any samples above Sassanium, but we did get two times out below on the float. More of a diversity in terms of parasites, but again, pretty clean in terms of the pathogens we were looking for. Nanophytes, most of you know the seven poison disease, the trematode that carries that rickettsia, was found in pretty much every salmonid that we looked at, a high frequency of that, and then a little bit more moderate frequency of other trematodes, an Apophallus and Sanguinicola, which is a blood fluke, and then low frequency of roundworms again. Did now pick up two myxozoan parasites, small spores that will insist. In this case, insidiosis in the muscle. Squamous will insist on the body surface or in the scale pockets.
So, question: do you have a way to compare above and below the hatchery?
Not yet. This one, again, like I said, we didn't get any samples yet from above Sassanium. Again, trying to work maybe if someone is running a trap or something on Foster to get samples from above. Just examples of what we saw popping up now in South San Diego. There's a phallus, you can see that's a metapsycharia, that's a life stage of it in the gill. Same stage, but anemophytes. And then the two myxozoans that we're seeing, that's just a highly magnified of the spore. And moving on to the Mackenzie-Lieberg area. So how that worked, we would put in just below Lieberg Dam and then float down past Mackenzie and end just below Mackenzie. And we did get some above Lieberg from the dam with the screw trap and the bypass. As you see, the overall, the spread looks pretty similar in terms of parasites. Nanophytes again being highly frequent, and all the salmonids, then lower moderate frequency in the other flukes, and then even lower frequency in the roundworms. One thing to note, though, there was one instance of a low-level BKD we picked up in one of the rainbows in this area, just between Lieberg and Mackenzie, and also an instance of some Kobe pods, a low level of that we picked up below. So Kobe pods, the overview of what we got, Kobe pods not being pathogenic in themselves, but they can be problematic, especially, as you can see here, kind of causing some gill damage. If they're in higher numbers, they can be also cause secondary infection. So
something to note when you are looking at fish. Finally, looked at Dexter and did our main float again below, and then did get some samples above from the gillnet project in Lookout Point. They weren't as diverse compared to above. Again, this was different habitat, and also the gillnet was getting larger fish, more adult fish, so that could also kind of attribute to the differences in what we're seeing here. But interestingly, there was a much higher level of, or much higher frequency of copepods on those fish compared to pretty much all the younger fish that we see. That might just be a case of them being older or where they live. But so that's pretty much it for the what we found. Kind of so far and all in all, what I've seen this summer, that the specific pathogens we were looking at weren't very prevalent in the samples we got. One kind of unfortunate limitation to just sampling fish in the wild is if there is an epizootic, those can be very quick, and then any fish that are sick or dead, they get removed very quickly because of predation or just the flow of the river. So that is one thing that is influencing what we're seeing levels. Also, just the timing. As you can see, we went in July and August, and we saw the hatcheries were very clean, so it could be an instance of that the pathogens weren't in high level at that time. Going on from there, need to combine and analyze data from last year. Michelle did get some wild fish from last year, so hope to combine that all in one and start doing more analysis with that. As it continues, hope to collect fish pretty much right now. Would be a great time to collect, as there are outbreaks happening, to see if we start picking up any of those pathogens. If it's more of a just something you have to pick up as an outbreak is happening. And just in general, need more samples, especially as you can see, South San Diego needs some above for some comparison, and just to get more overall. Because if these are a lower level of prevalence, especially in a healthier time, you need just more samples to pick that up. And then going on from there, I'd be interested to pursue just any environmental indicators in the fish, or in fish, but also just in the system itself. That might relate to when their outbreaks are happening. And also maybe even looking into what role the adults play in spreading disease, so chronic disease and all that, or spreading pathogen. So that's about it. Is there any questions? Oh, first of all, I'd like to thank everyone on the Army Corps and ODFW especially for all the time and support.
So you were sampling a variety of a number of different species there. I guess I was curious, were the copepods or other diseases for that matter restricted to just salmonids or a particular species within
Oh yeah, all those graphs were just for some runs. So yeah, so I took, we did have other stuff, but for the that data right there, that was all some runs. But I did see some other. I didn't see any of the pathogens specifically come up, the specific bacterial viral. But in the other ones, you did see different variety and sometimes a higher instance of different like trematodes and stuff in like say white fish.
Possible
that
the non-cell monitors, or even the whitefish, which are cell
monitors,
could be reservoirs for things that are spilling over into the trout.
Yeah, and that is a question. So what I've seen, yeah.
I mean, if they're gaslit,
I guess they're not as specific. The specific ones, I know just for comparing, we're looking specifically at, you know, what would be also in the hatcheries. So that's where we're focusing there, just to have a greater, comparison between that. But yeah, that would be an instance, and that's why we are also sampling at a lower level. But we were taking other fish from that to see if there was there, which in this case it wasn't. But again,
so were cutthroat? Did they comprise a significant proportion of your salmonids?
Cutthroat in some areas they did, especially in like Dexter, below Dexter, the cutthroat and rainbow or steelhead rainbow were. A higher percentage than say shrimp on certain areas.
The answer to you guys is yes. Non-cell monids carry a lot of the external parasites to levels where they do impact salmonids and impact hatcheries as well. Internal parasites are because of the cycles of hosts. You know, they really don't impact hatcheries. They're not there eating over pods or eating off the bottom. So we don't have those issues, but the external parasites are fairly highly impacted by what's in the water supply.
That's it. I'm going to hand it over to Sasha.
So I'm going to talk briefly a little bit more about the water sampling, since my main role in the project is to develop molecular methods. So we can not just detect, but also determine how much of the pathogen is present in the system. So detect it directly from the water sampling. It would be ideal, ultimately, if we didn't have to undertake those sentinel fish exposures, because they're quite time intensive, and obviously we use a lot of fish in the process as well. So to be able to directly detect if a pathogen is present and how much in a water sample is our goal here. Michelle mentioned that about her water sampling that she's doing, and that she's taking subsamples and culturing those. But unfortunately, when she cultures, because it's an environmental water sample, there's all sorts of bacteria that are present, and it's very difficult to be able to distinguish your target from all the other ones, and also to be able to quantify. So that's the reason why we're going to molecular methods, so that we can determine how much of a specific pathogen is present, because culturing obviously is well developed, but it's not going to meet the needs that we'd like. All right, so I'm going to focus too mainly on the bacterial side of things. As Michelle mentioned, we take water samples when the fish are placed in the water as well as when they're removed. We take triplicate water samples, 1 litre at a time, and we take them obviously above and below the hatchery. And so this past year, this has occurred every single week from August through September. And then when there's an outbreak, we also take triplicate samples, but in addition to above and below, we take them from the afflicted ponds as well as from multiple sites downstream to get an idea of the dilution effect. Alright, so I should mention too that there's three main parts to development of these assays, and of these methods I should say, because none actually exist for any of these pathogens and are in use. So the three main things were to develop the actual filtration method. So your size of the filter paper, how much water should we actually filter? So we decided to do 1 litre based on our experiences working with a metazoan parasite, Ceratomyxa shasta, which is a little bit bigger obviously than these bacteria that we're working with, but it gave us a bit of an introduction for all of this. So we worked with 1 litre samples, and then we filter them through. We mainly worked on the Klamath River with Ceratomyxa, and we got a lot of clogging of the smaller sized filter papers, so hence we went to a larger surface area. We also went to a larger surface area because previously we'd been working with organisms that were about 10 microns in size. These guys are a lot smaller, and we had used a 5-micron paper. We're now using 0.22, hence wanting to increase that surface area so we don't clog as often and don't have to work with as many filter papers. So that's the size we're working with. This is a typical sample. For instance, this is a setup just downstairs, and I can set up if anyone is actually interested, or at least point out the equipment. So we use a vacuum pump to help draw the water through the apparatus and actually through that filter paper, and then it just goes into a flask, and I just dump out that excess water. And this is a typical sample that's been filtered. So you can see here we've captured and concentrated everything that was in that 1 litre water sample that was 0.22 microns or larger in size. Then what we do is fold that up and place it into 50mm microfuge tube. And then the next step of the process that we had to work out was the DNA extraction. So we've captured everything, now we need to extract the DNA. And for that, we dissolve the filter paper in a series of acetone and alcohol, and then we just use a standard kit. All right, so our aim is to extract the total DNA present, so we can use the one water sample and test it for multiple pathogens. And of course, we can archive these samples and come back to them too, and not just look at them for bacterial pathogens, but anything else that's that size or above, because we've captured it and we've preserved it. And the main thing we're working on at the moment is working out all these molecular assays. So there's a whole bunch of PCRs that have been developed, which are the traditional means for doing molecular analyses on regular samples. Most of these pertain to fish tissue samples, so obviously you've got a narrower range of organisms that are present, whereas we're struggling with dealing with environmental water samples, so everything is present here. And so we're sort of working our way through the literature and doing a lot of trialing and erroring to work with quantitative PCRs that may already be in existence. So the quantitative PCR is what we're aiming for, because not only does it tell us whether a pathogen is present or not, but it tells us how much is there. And of course, that's what we want to ascertain. We want to see if there's a difference in pathogen levels above and below a hatchery. So basic mainstream molecular methods will tell us if it's there or not, but we want to go to quantitative PCR so we can ascertain, is there a difference in pathogen level, and can we track that over time through the monitoring process so we can then ascertain when it's at a level that's of concern with regards to alerting us to an outbreak. So I said most of the quantitative PCRs, if they have been developed for our target pathogens, they've been used for tissue samples, not for water. So this whole combination of things, the water filtration, the extraction, and the molecular assays have not been ever applied to environmental water samples like this for these pathogens. So it's been a lot of, as I said, trial and error involved here. Some of the things we're working our way through are determining the limit of detection for each of the pathogens, so the sensitivity of the assay. So for instance, we were working with quantitative PCR for Flavobacterium cyprophyllum, and we had some cultures, and we do a dilution series, and we can see when how effective the assay is, and we can see we have sensitivity to about here, which corresponds to about 50 organisms. We'll see a few. And the other thing we're also particularly interested in is the specificity of the assays. As I said, we're working with environmental samples, and we want to make sure that we only amplify our target. So we've cultured up a whole range of other pathogens, and we're trialing the qPCRs on those to make sure we only amplify the one we're interested in and not on other things that may be present in the water. What we also did this year was to develop reference sample sets for each of those target pathogens. So, as I said, we use the quantitative PCR to enumerate the pathogen, and we get this a CQ value. It's just the computer spits out a value to us, and it's meaningless unless we know how many organisms that corresponds to. So Michelle went and did cultures of all our pathogens, and we did dilution series, and we paralleled that with culturing as well as placing directly on filter paper, so we knew from Michelle's work how many cells she had, or CFUs rather, on that plate, and how many we put into our tubes, and we can therefore work out our sensitivity of our assays from that. So we knew when we get this computer number, what does it actually mean with regards to number of organisms? So that was a big thing for us this year, was developing those reference sample sets for all the different organisms. All right. So we're just working our way through at the moment, applying those different assays to the samples and determining the limit of sensitivity and the specificity. to our targets.
And I'll just add that in addition to the water samples that we're collecting above and below, Carl Schreck's group has also been supplying some water samples from their transport containers, so we can look at transmission, what kind of pathogen transmission might be occurring during transport. We hope to add a couple other collection sites next year, perhaps in the latter at Willamette Falls during adult migration. Look at what pathogens they might be encountering in the latter itself. And Sean's interested in getting out on the spawning grounds and looking at what kind of pathogens might be present in the water during spawning. So those are just a couple other potential applications.
So do you have your qPCR assays up and working?
No. No.
Do you have a good sequence to work off of to design those?
The aim was not to have Jeff to start from scratch, because there are a handful already out there, and we're trying to, but they're being developed for fish tissue, and then when we've been applying them to the water samples, we're having issues with specificity. We're getting amplification where I would not like to see amplification. So that's the main thing at the moment, is adapting those to these other sample sets. And then I've gone back to using PCRs as well then, where they've had specificity. My background's not in bacteria, and I tried not to, I didn't want to have to go back to right back to the beginning and do all the alignments and design and whatnot if there were things already in existence. My main goal was to combine existing methodologies, especially where they've already trialed them to a whole lot of, a whole slew of different bacteria that may be present. So go on other people's work and adapt those and for this unique combination. So that's the goal, but it's not working as readily as I would like for some of them.
This is really difficult work because you're dealing with environmental samples, yeah, which are just loaded with all kinds of things, and some are closely related to the pathogens we're dealing with. There are a lot of flavor bacteria out there, there's a lot of aeromonads out there. So it's really, I'm amazed actually how far they have advanced in this short period of time, and if and when this works, it's going to be groundbreaking for sampling all over. No one else has done this before,
right.
So it's fantastic.
So the methodologies are out there, it's just never been done before? Or are you sort of inventing the methodology?
No, we're inventing it the whole way.
Yeah.
This, based on our experience with Serrata Mixer, which has been, which obviously was troublesome at first as well, just putting the whole combination together. But once we got it working, we've been using it now for 6-8 years, and developing, gaining all this information on distribution and abundance of another parasite, and we're now using it throughout the state. So once we get over this hump, we'll be okay. But again, it's environmental water samples, and I just didn't want to have to reinvent the wheel for certain aspects if it's already out there.
The one thing we have done with water samples is part of another project, but it's going to overlap onto this one, is we've had index sites in the Willamette River for the past 2 years, and we've been looking at the spatial and temporal distribution of Serrata Mixa and Shasta. And now we can use those same samples to go back and look at other pathogens like Parvocapsula that appear to be problematic in adult salmon. So we can use those samples to go back in and look at metazoan parasites. Yeah, they're using a bigger filter, so we can't look at bacteria with those. But that's one of the things we'll be doing this winter. I have an undergraduate who's going to take all those samples and go back in and look at that distribution.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Can you speculate on what's your guess? Do you need a lot of samples to analyze in order to get a good idea of what's out there, or do you think a few samples are really representative of what's going on?
From our experience with Serrata Mixa, it looks like it's good mixing in the system. So I'm happy with our triplicates. I like the stats, we need more than two, and I always like more than one just as a backup in case you spill. I mean, I haven't spilled a sample yet, but I don't want to spill a sample, so I always like having more than one just for personal security. And then N=3 obviously is always a good number. A lot of people, when they're doing this filtering too, when they've actually done, some people have done filtering of pond water and whatnot, but they've used hundreds of mils, as in 250 mils. To me, that doesn't really get at what the fish are experiencing. I mean, they're experiencing thousands of litres, and we just want to go and take this little bit. So hence, I was more comfortable upping it to at least a litre and doing triplicates of that. So I think, as long as we have our triplicate samples, With Serrata Mixer, for instance, I know I keep going back to that, we overdid it for a while there. So for a whole year, we were sampling twice a week at half a dozen index sites. We had more data than we could make sense of, so we cut back to once a week. So my feeling is once a week. We can also have we also have automatic water samplers, so they can collect every couple of hours for a 24-hour period, and that all gets put into the one container, and then we can subsample manually from that. And so that way we get a 24-hour composite sample, which appeals to me, because with things like Serrata Mixer, we notice that there can be differences throughout the day as to whether the pathogen's present or not. So if we get this 24-hour sample, it's more representative of what the fish may experience. So we've changed the protocol a little bit throughout like that. So no, I feel pretty confident that once we get over these couple of early humps, then we'll be off and running. Once we iron out a few things, then we can just process. The only thing that'll be an issue for us will be things like inhibition, which we've had to deal with. But we just test for that. We have internal positive controls, and we test for that, and then we just have to dilute the sample to deal with inhibition, which you often get environmental samples. So again, I feel like our Serrata Mixer work has put us in a good place for dealing with this. It's just getting the combination right.
Any more questions?
Yes.
Quick question. So I know that you saw quite a few trematodes, and some of them are directly infected from sea carrier, right, which would be in the water.
Yeah, yes. So we can theoretically, we'll detect anything, capture anything. But I understand with some of the life cycles, though, that some of these organisms may be more bottom dwellers,
right,
or
they wouldn't perpetuate in the hatchery, but if they were coming into the water, that's just direct security infection. And that is pulsed with the water temperature and sunlight, sorts of things that secure all the release.
Right, and most facilities, though, the sheer velocity of the water prevents any major infections. Facilities with low water flows, we do see cercarial problems, and in some cases actually we do see problems with infections with external parasites, but those are usually the coastal facilities where we have a lot of water. Not really an issue in the Willamette Basin because of the massive flows that we have.
We have time for one more question? Anyone? All right, great. Hey, thank you so much. That was an excellent presentation, Jerry and your team. Let's quickly move on to a brief discussion of this database.
Well, Stephen gets up there. Go ahead. This is something that I've been pushing internally in the agency for about the last 6-7 years with very little success. I was finally able to convince the powers that be that using sports fish restoration dollars, peanuts actually, compared to my entire program, that we should go forward. And as a matter of fact, they wanted to cut it after year one, and I convinced the powers that be that we should continue with year two, and that year three probably is necessary. And you'll see why. I think this is something that is going to give information out to not just you guys, but to the public. We get calls all the time regarding what people see. Is it going to kill me? Can I eat it? On and on and on and on, that type of thing. So Stephen is leading this. I know nothing about this kind of stuff, so I'm very, very happy to have Stephen involved with this.
Well, I'm Steve Atkinson. I'm a postdoc scholar in Jerry's lab at OSU. Together with Sasha, we're working with one of the computer guys at OSU to design and implement an online database. The primary sort of the umbrella, as Tony indicated, is really just to sort of indicate something that's online that people can access, that encounters pathogens from Oregon's fishes. The key to it is that it's going to be accessible and useful to a broad audience, so that's both members of the public as well as you guys fish health professionals. That's our sort of driving goal. The data that we're incorporating into it is sort of basically a subset of textbook data on what pathogens are there, what is their host, target tissues, general informative stuff. The text will be pitched at a level where members of the public can get on there and understand. There'll probably be a myriad advanced information, again, for fish up professionals trying to cater for both aspects of the audience. We're going to be basically populating it with a very large volume of images that we have in our own collections. I'll get to that later. As well as the key to more the professional and the extended aspects of what this can do come into where we are tying it back to actual occurrences of parasites in hatchery, wild, cultured populations of fishes from fish pathology records from ODFW. And again, the point of having this database is really to consolidate the situation as it exists now, where there are multiple databases out there, wildfish, viruses, hatchery, in different agencies, as well as contribute. We've got access to some private collections from fish pathologists within the IDFW framework, and, within the OSU framework, and we very much like to bring all of that together into a cohesive single database. So as you guys know, IDFW has a lot of data. Certainly just from our exposure with Craig Banner at the OSU IDFW lab, he's got a heap of data on occurrence of pathogens. He's got some great images of pathogens, but are they available to the general public? No, we need to get it into a nice format. So basically, yeah, the situation as it stands, the data is not readily accessible, let alone like even within your agency, outside the agency, members of the public. And this is due to a whole range of factors. There's different data formats, different hardware platforms, Apple's PCs, different software, different versions of software. A lot of the older data is hard copy. It's just in lab notebooks. It's in slides. So we envisage this thing where we can bring all of that together into an online format. The other key thing we've noticed is that there's a great sort of cohort of the IDFW guys who are retiring. And we sort of see this basically careers worth of examination records and things that'll just go with them. I mean, sure, the lab books are still there, but we really, without the person who's written the lab book to interpret it, there's a lot of data there that could go missing. So hence the push at this time and place was to seize the opportunity before we lose contact with people. And again, the fundamental thing with why this we see the value to the public in this is that fish are such a central aspect of Oregon culture. And as Tony mentioned, the ODFW get a lot of inquiries about, I've just caught a fish, it's got white spots on it, can I eat it, is it going to infect me? These real general questions, and if we've got some nice, a nice accessible promoted database out there where they can go online, we feel that'll ease the burden of just these real mundane inquiries to ODFW. So what I'm going to show you is a series of pages where because the database isn't finished yet, it's not implemented online. We are building it online, hopefully as we speak. So I've shown you a mock-up of pages incorporating some of the aspects that are working and some of the aspects that are planned. This is basically what we would see as a home page where straight up there's a graphical display of the top stuff people are likely to ask about and want to know about, as well as a real general introduction to what the site's about. So then the core of the site, as I've listed here, are basically summaries of the pathogens with printable fact sheets. I know IDFW has currently got a great set of invasive species fact sheets. We see a very similar thing where it will just be a one-page description of what the parasite is, where you find it, what its hosts are, with some nice pictures. That will be printable directly from the web pages. The library of images I mentioned. The key here for more of a fish health professional data synthesis aspect is that the data will be searchable and will incorporate the fish exam records, which are currently not readily searchable, as well as some of the higher level stuff. Is once we've geolocated where the fish were caught, what pathogens were found there, we can start to synthesize maps of what are the actual pathogen distributions versus what we know from the textbook or the literature, as well as, again, for the member of the general public, frequently asked questions and a glossary of terms. The glossary will work where it will be available on every page, so if people see words they don't understand, most of the complex words, you'll mouse over and it will give you a definition as a little tooltip on your mouse cursor. Again, trying to make this more accessible and approachable to the public. So I'm going to go through examples of just what the sort of the core pages are going to be like. Each pathogen will have a pathogen information page, which will give a plain English description of the parasite, as well as a concise scientific summary. The key thing here, as much as possible, we're going to define whether these things are zoonotic or not. I mean, given the number of pathogens out there are so few that are zoonotic, we really need to sort of hammer that home, that look, just because it's a parasite, you don't need to get worried about it, just cook it and eat it. Well, you don't even necessarily need to cook it, but and so the some of the the graphical things that are available in terms of when you build these web pages now is that there'll be like revolving carousels of images where, you know, there could be 50 images of this parasite, but we're not like hitting them in the face with it. They just click and they'll see a sort of a revolving slideshow. There'll be multiple ways of searching the data. As I said, we're trying for a very much an image-intensive information source so people can see things. This is an example of the photographs we've got in there so far. It's a subset for test purposes. One of the searching methods will just be browsing the image gallery. You see a parasite you want to find more about, you click through and you'll get the information page. You see an image, you click through, you'll get a blown-up page of the image. This is an example of what an image page would look like. You get a larger version of it, and then details of both a summary of the pathogen that's in the image, as well as details of where the actual image came from. Again, trying to tie it back to the original record as much as possible so we know exactly when and where it was found. And then, because it's a website versus a textbook, there'll be horizontal navigation where you can ping pong back to pathogens or go sideways to other images of the parasite. And then really the core in terms of the real data in the site is going to be these pathogen records, where as much as possible we will incorporate and standardize the existing databases. We're starting with Craig Banner's database because it's his wildfish database, because it incorporates a very broad range of pathogens and hosts, and it lets us check a lot of the boxes right up front. But it also is the trickiest aspect of the database, and it's something that we didn't appreciate until we got down into actually assembling this thing, that to take a fish record and correctly work out the best and fastest way of importing it and splitting it up into the database so that you can then go back later and correctly search for, well, you know, how many times is this parasite, how many fish have been examined, is pretty tricky, and we're this is the core development that we're in at the moment, just trying to really work out this record thing, because it is so important. So in summary of where we're heading, we're aiming to go live to the public in July, and that will be the basic framework of the most common pathogens with records that reflect those. But certainly it's a database that is designed and should continue to grow indefinitely. Basically every time records are generated, they can go into the database. We also see, given that there's a world of opportunities opened up by having it as an online system, we see both timely data entry, something doesn't have to sit in the lab book for years. My vision of where this could head is to be given the proliferation of tablet PCs, I see no reason why you could not have your data entry form there while you're actually doing the fish exam. So instead of Craig writing some notes, typing into his database and then getting uploaded later, this could be a one-shot deal. There's no reason why you cannot immediately go into an online database right there on your workbench. Because then we can have checks and balances in that process. It's not like you type something in and immediately Joe Public can see it. It would be very much a situation, I call it the NASA model, where they generate all this data, but there's always a six-month lag before it's available to the public, which allows interagency working on it, cross-checking of the data, finalization of assays and things. And the other key thing I see about going directly into an electronic format would be facilitation of report generation. You can get immediate up-to-date synthesis of the data. As I said, electronic lab notebooks, this is really being technology-driven at the moment. The tablet PCs are very commonly available. They're coming down in price. Data mining is a potential of any electronic system, and here's where we see with the more data we have in there, the more opportunities there are for synthesizing it and finding out long-term trends in terms of hosts and their parasites. And certainly something that is very popular in things like plant databases is this aspect of crowdsourcing or birds and things where members of the public can go, oh, look at this, like, here's a picture of this bird I just saw, what is it? I think that's sort of less accessible in terms of this database because a lot of these parasites are microscopic. But still, there is a potential there that we could do some promotion through asking people to upload their images if they've got funny spots on a fish. There could be a facility to ask an expert through a query form directly on the website if the website itself can't provide them with an answer. So as I said, July 2013 is what we're aiming at. Certainly if anybody's got any feedback at this point, any things like, oh, we really should include this, or I know, oh, there's this guy who's got this awesome database, or there's this great box of slides in our Salem office, or anything like that, we're open. Thank you.
So perhaps you mentioned it, but either annotated or even non-annotated bibliography about the different pathogens? Is it?
That's part of the struggle in designing it is really determining what our boundaries are, because it's electronic data and you can just keep on creating new fields to add to it indefinitely. For us, it's been quite a challenge to work out what are our limits for this data. And really, we're not aiming to reproduce the Hoffman text of fish pathogens of North America. The pathogen data that we have here is probably going to be more a concise, accurate description, and hence bibliographical. There might be we're building in at the moment in terms of a links out to other, if you want to know more sort of things, specific data on pathogens.
Yeah, we're trying to avoid duplicating information that's already out there. So hence the novel part of this is Oregon, pathogens of Oregon. What's been found here and when and where. There's already some great reference material. For instance, the Alaskan group have got this great online as well as hard copy of pathogens in Alaska, and it's really nicely presented, and we'll link to theirs. Because our idea is not to just regurgitate what they've already written. We sort of want to have it from an Oregon perspective to start with.
The Alaskan example is a great one because it really took a load off the shoulders of their staff. Shot this moose, what's this? It's very graphic online. If you've ever used it, it's wonderful. It's a good model.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But theirs is, and again, theirs isn't quite tailored to what we've got, and really the core of this database is incorporating the actual observations from you guys, the pathology records from Oregon fishes.
And making it searchable.
I need to interrupt just a minute here. We can go back to discussion, but you need to all dig deep into your pockets now if you want your sandwich. You're paid up. But Ruth is ready to go pick them up.
Are you here for the sandwich orders?
One of the things with this is that it's going to be based at OSU, not with ODFW. And we have not presented this to the ODFW ISD staff yet, and they're rather possessive. Rather difficult to work with, so it will be interesting to see what happens when that goes.
We've already secured the website name, so we've already paid for that, and that's the way it is. And we decided initially sort of about having it as Pathogens of Oregon, something to do with Oregon. We thought, Oregon already gets records from Idaho, Washington. Let's think a little bit bigger than that. So even though the focus at the moment is Oregon, we kept it a brief, more general name, so hence it's fishpathogens.net. So it's secured, it exists, and we've paid for it for 5 years. And as Tony said, OSU was hosting the website for us.
Don't tell
ODFW. We have to, unfortunately.
Hey, it's easier to get well.
Great, thank you very much. Did you say who's funding this?
It's been funded through
So Fish and Wildlife Service and 25% of us state funds. That's the problem right now, is the 25%
of the core, I think.
Yeah.
Is NERCO.
Okay.
All right.
Do I have everybody?
Nope. Next on the agenda, after we give Jerry our money so we can have a sound, is we're going to get a personalized tour of the lab.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, would you rather have me run through the survey results first, and then that's done, and then all that's left after that, I believe, are the tours?
Well, we're going to talk about fish disposition, outplant protocols. We can do that this afternoon. That'll be a brief conversation.
Okay.
So, is Jerry still standing there?
She's gone.
We can do this right now, Cameron. We can talk about your stuff, or we can do the lab if she's ready for us. I don't know if there was a particular tour that we're going to be given for that.
Here's the box.
Okay.
Let's walk for a few minutes.
I think we should go do a tour.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah, we can do the tour.
Are we going out of the building? We need jackets?
Yeah.
There's stockings outside, so yeah. Probably, but not for...
Dan Peck
has left the conference.
Ron, you sticking around?
Yeah, I'm going to see the tour.
All right.
Yeah. Eat my lunch and then probably go after that.
Right. You're leaving the afternoon, Travis. As you know,
an absolute disaster.
That's how long we were there.
Yeah.
I hear you. So where did Brian go?
So how are you?
Pretty good. How are you?
He's down outside of Monterey.
Oh, really?
Jerry can lead the tour as soon as you're all ready. So
if you're ready,
feel free to go downstairs to the main lab, which is downstairs there on the right.